Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 71.
The Demon King, Sai Tai Sui, has Wukong basically cornered.
Completely, yeah.
The demon's in a frenzy, searching everywhere, having, as the text says, tightly shut front and back doors, ordering strict guards with bows strung, knives drawn. I mean, it sounds like a total lockdown.
It absolutely is an impossible situation, seemingly.
So what's Wukong's first move in a spot like that?
Well, Wukong's initial response, it really exemplifies covert intelligence gathering through extreme inconspicuousness.
Okay.
He doesn't try to fight his way out or even just hide in the conventional sense. Instead, he transforms into a silly housefly.
A housefly.
Yeah, just a simple housefly. And this isn't just about evasion. It's actually a brilliant tactical decision. It gives him unhindered access to the enemy's most secure areas.
Right, because who notices a fly?
Exactly. The insight here is that sometimes the most powerful kind of reconnaissance comes from being utterly overlooked.
Yeah.
So he becomes this invisible spy inside the demon's own palace.
An invisible spy. Okay, that's where this gets really fascinating. So as this tiny fly, where does his intelligence gathering lead him first? What does he find?
So as a fly, he makes his way into the back palace. And he finds there, it's a figure weeping quietly. It's the Golden Saint Empress, Jin Sheng Niang Yang.
Ah, the Empress.
Yes. And her lament is incredibly poignant. She's weeping continuously with faint sounds of sorrow. And she actually recites a poem that lays bare her suffering.
What does it say?
She's been separated from her true love for 3 years by this she calls him a brutal, monstrous king. But crucially, she also mentions a previous attempt to communicate, one that failed because of a golden bell.
Wow. Okay, so a weeping empress, this shared connection through the golden bell, and Wukong listening in as a fly. But how on earth do you gain the trust of a terrified empress, a prisoner, when you're literally just a fly? I mean, she could just swat him.
Right. And this is where his strategy gets remarkably nuanced. He doesn't go for some grand, flashy reveal.
No.
No, it's a very careful, almost empathetic approach.
Yeah.
He lands, the text says, gently on her dark cloud bun, her hair.
Okay.
And then he whispers his identity. I'm your divine monk son, elder. I haven't been harmed. But, and this is key, the real clincher for building rapport is what he does next.
What's that?
He immediately explains his own predicament with the golden bell. Tells her how he stole the golden bell and how it accidentally rang, spewing smoke and yellow sand, which forced him to reveal his true form and then eventually transform into a fly just to escape.
Ah, so she shares his own vulnerability?
Precisely. That shared vulnerability creates this immediate, unexpected bond. He's not just some random potential rescuer. He's someone who actually understands her situation, at least partially.
That makes a lot of sense. Sharing his own struggle would definitely break down some barriers, but still, her first reaction is fear. Right? Disbelief. She asks, are you human or ghost?
Naturally, yes. She's terrified.
So how does Wukong, still a tiny fly, convince her he's real? What's the next step?
He gives her immediate, vivid sensory proof. Real proof.
Wow.
He invites her to open her hand, and then he gently flies down right onto her jade palm. And the text, it gives this beautiful, almost poetic imagery to describe it. It really makes the moment stick.
Like what?
It says he's like a black bean on a lotus bud, a wandering bee resting on a peony, a grape fallen inside a hydrangea, a thick black dot beside a lily branch.
Wow, that's very specific.
Incredibly specific. And that tactile detail, her seeing and feeling this tiny fly on her palm, it makes his presence undeniable. It completely seals her belief. Her fear starts to turn into this, you know, tentative trust. It's a masterclass, really, in grounding something unbelievable in concrete reality.
Okay, got it. So trust established. They're still both trapped inside this heavily guarded palace. What's the next phase of Wukong's ingenious plan? He needs to get out, obviously, but also neutralize this demon king.
Right. And this is where Wukong shifts gears again. Now he moves to exploiting the enemy's vulnerabilities through, well, strategic deception.
Deception. Okay.
He proposes luring the demon king into the palace, using conjugal rites, basically playing on the demon's desire for the empress, and critically, using alcohol.
Ah, wine, the classic weakness.
Exactly. And Wukong even quotes ancient wisdom here. He says, wine can ruin a life, but also nothing is better than wine to resolve all matters.
Huh. So acknowledging its dual nature.
Precisely. He understands it can be a downfall, but also a powerful tool for manipulation. So he's planning to use the demon's own desires and weaknesses right back at him.
Brilliant. Okay, but once the demon is lured in, probably with guards around. How does Wukong actually plan to execute whatever he has in mind? He can't just pop out as a monkey.
No, definitely not. This calls for another one of his, signature moves, transformation and deep infiltration.
Right, makes sense. How does he do it this time?
So the execution is incredibly precise. Wukong asks the Empress to identify a maid she trusts.
Okay.
She calls for Chun Zhao, who, interestingly, turns out to be a jade-faced fox spirit.
A fox spirit, okay.
Wukong doesn't waste a second. He immediately flies onto Chun Zhao's head, plucks out a single one of his own hairs, blows a mortal breath on it, and transforms that single hair into a sleepy bug.
A sleepy bug from a hair.
Yeah, it's a perfect example of him creating these very specific, targeted magical tools for a particular operational goal.
Okay, a sleepy bug into the nostril, the text says. That's quite specific. How well does it work? Is it slow acting?
Oh, it's instantaneous.
Yeah.
And incredibly effective. The bug crawls into the nostril and boom, immediate profound sleep.
Just like that.
Just like that. Chun Zhao staggers and nods off, just collapses into this deep, sudden slumber. And with the maid completely incapacitated, totally out of the way.
Then Wukong makes his move.
Exactly. He performs his final perfect transformation, taking on Chun Zhao's exact appearance.
Wow.
So now he's ready to operate from within the demon's own household.
Then the Golden Saint Palace lady, she goes to invite Sai Tai Sui to come rest, after he's been out looking for Wukong and found nothing. So it just perfectly sets the stage for Wukong to get close.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So here's where it gets really interesting. Sai Tai Sui, he's obviously jumpy, worried about Wukong, who just, quote, disappeared without a trace.
Mm-hmm.
But the lady, she calms him down. And Wukong, still disguised as Chun Zhao, slips into the inner rooms with the other maids.
Yeah. And then the mood shifts, doesn't it? It becomes about feasting, flattery. The lady calls for wine, to relieve the king's fatigue. And Wukong, still playing the part of Chun Zhao, he's there helping arrange the fruit, the meat. They share these double happiness cups. And Wukong's even like encouraging them to drink up, lowering his guard.
Yeah. And then, boom, the distraction. The lady starts engaging Sai Tai Sui in this husband and wife talk.
Mm.
The text says it makes the demon king soft and numb to the bone, but then it adds this amazing line.
Oh, yeah.
He had no fortune, unable to get close. Mm. Poor fellow. Truly like a cat biting a urine bladder. Empty joy.
Huh. Yeah, it's pretty vivid.
So basically, he's kept busy, but totally frustrated.
Exactly. And you have to ask why this distraction. It's brilliant because it completely ties up Sai Tai Sui's attention, his physical focus, let's say.
Yeah.
It makes him vulnerable for Wukong's next move, but it all looks like a normal, intimate evening.
Okay, so Sai Tai Sui is thoroughly distracted, maybe a bit tipsy, definitely frustrated. The conversation then almost naturally turns to his treasure.
Mm.
The lady asks if his baobei was damaged in the earlier fight.
Right. And Sai Tai Sui says, no, it's fine. Just the cotton plug got pulled out and the leopard skin bag it was in got burned by Wukong. But then crucially, he says, I wear it at my waist.
That's it. The key piece of information.
That's exactly what Wukong needed to hear.
And Wukong's reaction is immediate, almost inevitable.
Yeah.
He hears this. Pulls out some of his magic hairs.
Just a few, yeah.
Chews them into powder, secretly puts them on Sai Tai Sui's body, blows on them with immortal energy, whispers, change.
It's so subtle.
What happens then? What do the hairs become?
They instantly turn into these three incredibly annoying little things. Lice, fleas, and bedbugs. Just pure irritation. And they immediately start biting Sai Tai Sui, making him itch like crazy, uncontrollably.
Ugh. Talk about an unpleasant surprise. Yep. So Sai Tai Sui starts scratching, pulls out some lice, looks at them.
Mm-hmm. Totally confused and uncomfortable.
And the lady, she's playing her part so well. She suggests maybe his underwear is old or hasn't been washed.
It just embarrasses him completely.
Right.
Her quick thinking here is fantastic. She even jokes, oh, emperors also have three imperial lice, trying to normalize it. And then she offers to help him catch them, but says he needs to take his clothes off.
Perfect excuse. Socially acceptable, makes total sense in the moment given the infestation.
Exactly. It gives Sai Tai Sui a perfectly logical reason to disrobe right there.
So he starts taking off his clothes layer by layer. And Wukong, still as Chun Zhao, is just watching intently. His clothes are crawling with fleas, bedbugs, dense lice, the text says.
Yeah, it's quite a scene.
But then he gets down to the third layer where the skin is revealed. And there they are, the golden bells. also covered in bugs.
This is the moment. The moment Wukong's been waiting for.
He jumps right in.
Seizes the chance, offers to help catch the lice off the bells themselves.
Oh, bold move.
Extremely. And Sai Tai Sui, he's just so overwhelmed, embarrassed, confused, maybe a bit drunk. He can't tell the real Chun Jiao from Wukong anyway. He just hands his three precious bells straight over to the imposter.
Incredible. And then the switch happens. Fast.
Super fast. Wukong takes the real bells, hides them somewhere on himself, pulls out one more hair.
Just one.
Just one. Transforms it into three identical fake bells. He even makes a show of inspecting them, pretends to clean them. Then, poof, he reabsorbs all the lice, fleas, and bedbugs back into himself. Gone.
Cleans up the evidence.
Yep. And then hands the fake bells back to the totally bewildered Demon King.
Who's none the wiser.
Completely oblivious, still foggy and at a loss, as the text says. He takes the fake bells and immediately gives them to the lady, tells her, keep them well this time, be careful, not like last time. He has no idea.
Wow. And the lady, playing along, she just takes the fake bells, puts them in a chest, locks it up.
Locks it with a gold lock, yeah. And then they just continue drinking like nothing major just happened.
It's just masterful deception. When you connect it all, his humiliation, his confusion, wanting to seem unfazed by the bugs.
It all made him blind. He was so caught up in his own state, his own vulnerability, that he couldn't see the switch happening right under his nose. He literally had the treasure on him, but his mind was just too compromised.
And the end of the night is almost funny. In a dark way. The lady suggests they, you know, sleep together.
Yeah, rubbing it in almost.
But Sai Tai Sui, still flustered, still without fortune, he actually says no. Says he'll go sleep with another maid somewhere else.
Wukong's.
And he's got this treasure, this bell, tucked away on his waist. He's basically achieved the objective.
So infiltration successful. Now, how does he get out?
Well, this is where it gets interesting. He changes back to his monkey form, first off.
Right.
Then an invisibility spell to just float over to the main gate.
Okay. Still stealthy at this point.
Ish. But then he gets to the gate, heavily locked, right? And he uses his weapon, the golden hooped rod.
The Ru Jingu Bei.
That's one. He uses it to magically unlatch the doors from the inside. Pretty neat trick.
Very neat. So he steps outside, mission accomplished, time to sneak away.
You'd think so. But no, that's not Wukong.
What does he do?
He immediately starts shouting. Like, at the top of his lungs.
Sharing what?
Demanding the Demon King, Sai Tai Sui, return the Golden Saint Empress. Just yelling it out there.
Wow. Okay, so much for a quiet exit.
Not even close. And he keeps this up. The text says three or four times, basically all night until dawn.
All night. The poor demons inside.
They're terrified. They don't dare wake up their master, Sai Tai Sui. So Wukong just keeps shouting.
That's a bold strategy. It's not just noise, is it?
No, it's psychological. He's making his presence known,
mm-hmm.
unavoidable, building frustration, maybe fear. Before they even meet face to face, it's pure Wukong.
Yeah.
Direct, confrontational, zero subtlety.
Okay, so he's been yelling all night. Dawn breaks. What happens then? Does he get bored?
Not a chance. He actually ups the ante, starts physically banging on the door now.
Oh, come on.
Seriously. Just hammering on it. So now the little demons, they have no choice. They frantically go and wake up Sai Tai Sui.
And Sai Tai Sui comes out obviously furious.
Absolutely raging, demands to know who's making all this racket.
And Wukong's response, does he finally say, it is I, Sun Wukong?
Nope. Still playing games. He comes back with this brilliantly cheeky line.
Which is?
I am the maternal grandfather invited from the kingdom of Zuzei. Here to take the Golden Saint Empress back to her country.
He claims to be her grandfather.
The maternal grandfather, yes. Specifically. Invited, no less. It's just absurd.
How does the Demon King even react to that? Does he just laugh?
That's the amazing part.
Yeah.
He kind of takes it seriously, or at least seriously enough to check.
What do you mean check?
He actually goes back inside to consult the Golden Saint Empress.
No way.
Yes. He asks her, do you have any relatives, like anyone with the surname Wei? Because Wei means outer or, you know, maternal grandfather.
And what does she say? She must know it's nonsense.
Well, she gives this really clever, kind of witty reply. She's sharp.
Okay.
She says the only time she really knows that character Wei being used like that is from this old text, the 1000-character classic.
Uh-huh.
In the phrase, Wai Shou Fuxun, which means something like externally receiving instruction. It's totally irrelevant, basically.
So it's a polite way of saying no.
Exactly. But the Demon King, he hears this obscure literary reference and somehow takes it as confirmation.
You're kidding.
I'm not. It's incredible. It just shows how maybe sheltered or naive he is compared to Wukong. He totally misses the sarcasm.
Or maybe just not very bright. Wukong's really playing him here.
So he comes back out, grabs his weapon, this big Swanhua battle axe, and demands to know who he's actually talking to.
And Wukong, still playing the part.
Oh, yeah. He calls the Demon King his virtuous nephew. Just doubles down on the absurdity.
Ah, and the Demon King finally sees him properly now, right? Sees he's a monkey.
Yes. And he is not impressed. He totally loses it, starts insulting Better, calls him a monkey-faced baboon, seven parts a ghost, you know, really laying into his appearance. This is where Wukong decides, okay, playtime is over. Time for the real introduction.
Ah, the mic drop moment.
Exactly. He tells the demon, basically, you want to know who I am? You sure you can handle it? Because knowing my name might just scare you to death.
Okay, setting the stage.
And then he launches into it. This incredible, detailed, boastful history of himself.
Where does he even start?
Right at the beginning. His birth. Not just any birth, born from a stone, heavens and earth, essence of the sun and moon. A stone fetus.
So establishing his credentials right away, supernatural origin.
Totally. He's saying, I'm not like you, I'm cosmic. And he jumps into his early days.
King of the monkeys.
King of the monkeys, gathering demons, being their marshal, easily beating other monsters, establishing his leadership and power from the get-go.
And the heaven stuff, right? The rebellion.
Oh, yeah. He covers the first time the Jade Emperor summoned him, gave him that stablekeeper job. Beat him, Owen.
Which he saw as an insult.
A huge insult. So he rebelled. Boldly raised an army, fought heaven's generals like Li Jing, Neza. Big names.
He's not holding back on the details. He's listing his victories against heaven itself.
Absolutely. He's showing zero fear of authority. Then he mentions the second summons.
Where they gave him the fancy title.
Great sage equal to heaven. Ki Tian Da Sheng. Sounds impressive, right?
Yeah, but knowing Wukong.
It wasn't enough. He then lists his real troublemaking. Crashing the peach banquet.
The party of the gods.
Uh-huh. Getting drunk. Stealing the pills of immortality, the golden elixir from Lao Jun.
These aren't small things. He's listing capital offenses against heaven.
Exactly. He's building this picture of someone utterly defiant and powerful, then the huge war.
The one where heaven threw everything at him.
100,000 fierce stars and evil constellations, heaven's net and earth's snare. He emphasizes the scale of the forces sent against him.
And he boasts he fought them all off.
Fought without defeat, he claims. Until they finally got him. But even that took help.
Who helped?
Erlang Shen, the great warrior god, and Taishang Lao Jun using his magic weapon. It took a combined effort of major powers to capture him.
So even his capture story makes him sound tough.
Completely. And then the execution attempts. Axe, hammer, sword, fire, lightning. None of it worked.
Because he's indestructible by this point.
Right. Then being cooked in Lao Jun's furnace, the 8 trigrams furnace, for 49 days.
Which should have finished him.
But didn't. He escaped, caused even more chaos. Mm. It just made him stronger, gave him his fiery eyes.
This is an incredible resume. What's left?
The ultimate showdown. His confrontation with the Buddha, getting tricked into the palm jump.
Ah, the famous story.
And being trapped under Five Elements Mountain for 500 years. Even this, his defeat, highlights that it took the Buddha himself to stop him.
So the whole story is basically saying, I'm unbelievably powerful and I've fought everyone.
Pretty much. And he wraps it up by mentioning his current gig, protecting the Tang monk on the journey west, adding that clincher, no demon fears him not.
Wow. Just wow.
Yeah. And the effect. The Demon King hears Wukong, Wukong, and instantly guesses, and oh, that guy is a scoundrel who wrecked heaven.
The name precedes him. The whole monologue worked.
Perfectly. It's pure psychological dominance through narrative. He's established exactly who he is and why the Demon King should be very, very worried.
But the Demon King still asks him why he's interfering. After all that.
He does. He asks why Wukong is meddling for the Zuzi Kingdom.
And Wukong's response, still indignant.
Oh, absolutely furious. He basically says, I accepted the king's hospitality. They treated me like a god, like a parent. I'm 1,000 times higher than that king, and you call me a slave for helping them.
Okay, so that's the final straw.
That's the trigger. Any insult to his honor, especially after that intro, it means fight time. He's basically daring the Demon King now.
All right, so the talking's done. The epic self-introduction is over. The insults have been traded.
Yep, finally the battle begins.
You can almost picture it, right? Wukong with his golden hooped rod.
The compliant rod, yeah.
Yeah.
Against Sai Tai Sui and his wind-bladed Swan Hua axe.
Sounds impressive. How's the fight described?
Oh, it's vivid. Lots of action words. Spitting clouds and mist, stirring stones and raising sand. You get the sense of real power being thrown around.
Supernatural chaos.
Definitely. Many moves back and forth, flashing golden light. Both are going at it, using their abilities.
And the stakes are clear. Wukong wants the queen back in her capital.
While the Demon King wants to keep her locked away in his mountain fortress. Clear motivations on both sides.
How long does this first round last?
They go for 50 rounds, the text says. 50 exchanges.
And is there a winner?
Nope. Apparently it's a dead heat at this point. Which actually says something about Sai Tai Sui's strength to hold off Wukong for that long.
True. Wukong usually makes short work of demons.
Right. So after 50 rounds, the Demon King calls for a pause.
A timeout. Why?
He claims he hasn't had breakfast yet and needs to eat.
Breakfast? In the middle of a legendary battle.
Seems a bit weird, right? But Wukong sees right through it.
What's the real reason?
Wukong knows Sai Tai Sui wants to go back inside to get the bell.
The treasure Wukong stole earlier. The source of some of his power.
Exactly. That stolen bell is crucial. The Demon King needs it back to stand a real chance. He's stalling to retrieve his weapon.
And Wukong lets him.
He does. He agrees to the break. But he does it with total confidence, almost mockingly.
What does he say?
Tells him basically, go on then, eat well. Get strong before you lead yourself to your death.
The Demon King.
Yeah, he confronts the Golden Holy Palace lady. He's demanding his powerful bells back from her.
And she's caught in the middle, basically. Scared for herself, scared for Wukong.
Exactly. She gives him fake bells. He's so sure of himself, so focused on his treasures.
He doesn't even suspect they're fake.
Not for a second. Which, you know, perfectly sets him up for the next beat. He goes and confidently challenges Wukong, thinking he's holding all the power.
But this is where it gets really good, isn't it? Because Wukong, ever the trickster.
Oh, yeah.
He immediately fires back, revealing his own set of purple gold bells.
And this is the moment, the real head scratcher. Sai Tai Sui sees them, and he's just floored, completely shocked.
I can't figure it out.
No. He's looking at Wukong's bells, thinking, how can these be identical to mine? He even apparently thinks, well, even if they were made in the same mold, there should be some tiny difference, right? A mark, a scratch.
But nothing. They look exactly the same.
So how is that possible if they supposedly got them independently? That's the first big question.
Okay, so that immediately pushes us into their origins. Where did these things come from?
Well, Sai Tai Sui surprisingly spills the beans. He says his bells came from Taking Sheen's deep source, refined way back in the 8 trigrams furnace, a supreme treasure left by Lao Jun.
Wow, okay. So a serious celestial pedigree there. These aren't just trinkets.
Definitely not. They're ancient, powerful artifacts from the, you know, the highest levels.
Wukong naturally has to one-up him. What's his claim?
His counterclaim is just as impressive and typically witty. He says his bells also came from Daozu burning elixirs in Dusit Palace, forged in the furnace.
So both claiming top-tier ancient celestial origins for these identical bells.
Okay, but then Wukong throws in this curveball. It's a detail that just makes you pause.
What is it?
He claims his bells are female and Sai Tai Sui's are male.
Male and female bells? Is he serious? Or just messing with him? Because Sai Tai Sui's reaction must have been priceless.
It's pure gold. It's classic Wukong, right? Using this totally nonsensical idea to throw his opponent completely off balance.
Right.
Sai Tai Sui, this big, powerful demon king, he's just baffled.
Yeah.
He's like, wait, how can elixir treasures, non-living things, have a gender? He just dismisses it, focusing back on the power.
But the seed is planted.
Exactly. Wukong's clever bit of misdirection, that little piece of metaphysical humor, it sets Sai Tai Sui up for an even bigger fall.
Which leads us right into the demonstration of power, or, well, lack thereof on Sai Tai Sui's part.
Precisely. Sai Tai Sui tries to use his bells. He shakes the first one.
Nothing.
Shakes a second. Still nothing. Shakes the third. Zip. No fire, no smoke, no sand. Nothing happens.
And he's just standing there, confused.
Utterly bewildered. And here's the funny part. He actually thinks the bells are afraid of the female.
No way. He bought into Wukong's female bell story.
It seems like it. That little trick actually lodged in his mind, creating this like psychological block. He thinks that's why they're failing.
When the real reason is they were fakes all along.
Exactly. The irony is just perfect. And it makes the contrast with Wukong's real bells even more dramatic.
So Wukong steps up.
Wukong grabs his bells, shakes all three at once, and bam. Instantly, this massive eruption of red fire, blue smoke, yellow sand.
Oh.
The source says it scorched trees and burned mountains. We're talking serious destructive power unleashed immediately.
And Wukong doesn't stop there, does he? He adds to the chaos.
Right. He's a strategist, too. He chants a spell, calls up this strong wind from the southeast.
Which would just whip that fire into a frenzy.
Totally. It intensifies everything, wrapping Saitai Sui in this terrifying inferno. The demon is completely trapped, scared out of his mind, seeing no way out. It looks like game over for him.
You'd think that's the end of it. Wukong wins, demon defeated.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
But then, just as things are at their worst for Saitai Sui, there's this sudden shift. You hear this powerful voice, and Guanyin Bodhisattva appears, just arrives on the scene.
Guanyin, okay, the Bodhisattva of compassion. What does she do?
She acts immediately. With just a willow branch and some sweet dew, she completely quells the fire, the smoke, the sand. Everything just stops. It's this incredibly serene, powerful intervention. The fight is over. Just like that.
Wow. Okay, so she saves Saitai Sui, but then comes the big twist, right? The revelation that changes everything.
This is the mind-bending part. Guanyin just calmly looks at Wukong and declares that the monster, Saitai Sui, he's actually my golden-haired lion.
Her pet lion?
Essentially, yes. She explains he escaped because apparently a shepherd boy fell asleep on the job and let him wander off.
Okay, hold on. So this terrifying demon king who stole a queen and fought Wukong with magic bells is actually Guanyin's runaway pet lion. How does that reframe the fight we just saw?
It throws everything up in the air, doesn't it? What looked like a clear case of good versus evil, Wukong fighting a dangerous demon. Suddenly it's, well, divine pet recovery.
Wukong must have been completely baffled.
Absolutely. He's standing there facing this huge moral confusion because from his point of view.
Yeah, from his perspective, this creature, this lion, was deceiving the king and queen, corrupting customs, ruining ethics and laws. He saw real harm being done.
Exactly. So he challenges Guanyin directly. He asks her, basically, how can you say he was eliminating disaster when he was causing so much trouble? It's a fair question.
How do we reconcile that? The apparent wrongdoing versus Guanyin's claim that it was somehow beneficial.
This is where the story dives deep into ideas of, like, cosmic justice and perspective. Guanyin gives this intricate backstory.
Okay, let's hear it.
She explains that the current king of this place, Zuzi Kingdom, when he was younger, a prince, he went hunting and shot a male peacock chick.
Oh, okay. Not good.
And the female chick, too. And these weren't just any peacocks. They were the children of the peacock bright king Bodhisattva, a very powerful figure.
So divine repercussions were coming.
Definitely. The Buddha mother heard about this and decreed a punishment for the prince, now the king. He was fated to suffer a broken marriage for 3 years and also a period of serious illness. It was a karmic retribution.
Okay, I see the setup. So where does the golden-haired lion fit into this cosmic plan?
Here's the really fascinating part. The lion, Guanyin's mount, had apparently overheard this prophecy being made.
Ah.
So he intentionally came down to the human realm to, as the story puts it, trick the queen, basically abduct her and keep her separated from the king.
Thereby fulfilling the broken marriage for 3 years, part of the king's ordained suffering.
Exactly. So in Guanyin's perspective, the lion wasn't just being randomly malicious. He was playing a specific role in fulfilling this karmic destiny, this necessary period of suffering for the king. By doing so, he was, in her eyes, eliminating disaster because the 3 years were now up. The curse was fulfilled, the debt paid.
Wow. Okay, that is complex. So an act that looks completely evil from ground level is actually part of a much larger divine balancing act.
Precisely. It's all about perspective. What seems like straightforward villainy serves a higher, hidden purpose in this grand karmic scheme.
So Wukong hears all this. But he's still Wukong, right? He's focused on the here and now, the rules that were broken.
You bet. We get this great ethical debate between them. Wukong is still like, look, this guy disgraced the queen, ruined the laws. He deserves death, or at least 20 heavy blows. He wants earthly justice.
He's thinking about the immediate victims, the disruption.
Right. But Guanyin, she's operating on that higher level. Mercy, cosmic balance.
Yeah.
She pleads for complete forgiveness for the lion.
How does she?
She argues that Wukong, sparing the lion, specifically for her sake, would count as his merit, his good deed in this whole adventure. Plus, she points out, the lion is actually quite vulnerable. Even one blow from Wukong's staff would probably kill him.
So she's appealing to Wukong's desire for merit, but also just asking for mercy for her. Well, her pet.
Essentially, yes. She's asking him to look beyond the immediate transgression to the bigger picture, the necessary role the lion played, however unpleasant.
And Wukong, after hearing the whole backstory, does he buy it?
He seems reluctant. You can tell he's not entirely comfortable letting the lion off scot-free after what he did. but he eventually agrees.
But with a condition, I remember.
Yes, a very practical Wukong condition.
Yeah.
He makes Guanyin promise the lion will never again privately descend to the human realm to cause great harm. Basically, keep your celestial pet on a leash.
Fair enough. So what happens in the final act?
Well, Guanyin commands the creature, and instantly the monster transforms back into his true form, this magnificent golden-haired lion.
And the bells. Wukong still has the real ones.
Right. Guanyin asks for them back. And Wukong, in typical fashion, pretends he doesn't have them, just for a moment.
Of course he does.
So Guanyin threatens him with the ultimate Wukong kryptonite, reciting the tight-knit cap sutra.
The headache spell. That always works.
Instantly. Wukong immediately caves, pulls out the real bells, and returns them.
And Guanyin.
She takes them and places them back around the lion's neck, securing them properly this time.
And then there's that final proverb, which really sums it all up, doesn't it?
It does. It's quite profound. Who untied the golden bells on the Yaksha's neck? The one who untied them still asks the one who tied them. It's a bit of a riddle. It suggests that even the person who resolves the immediate problem, who unties the bells, maybe Wukong stopping the chaos, still needs to seek understanding from the ultimate source, the one who tied them, who set the whole complex situation in motion.
It points to those hidden layers, the deeper causes behind events.
Absolutely. It reinforces that whole idea.
Mm-hmm.
What you see isn't always the full story. There are often hidden purposes, deeper meanings, orchestrated by forces we don't fully perceive.
The Bodhisattva Guanyin deals with the hound monster, puts the bell back on its neck.
The text says she just soared high and headed back to the South Sea. Wukong doesn't pause. The text says he tidies up his clothes, grabs his iron rod, and heads straight for the Shizai Cave.
No messing around.
None at all. He goes in and wipes out every single lesser demon and monster left hiding in there. It's a total sweep. Efficient. Brutal, maybe, but thorough.
Gets the job done. So the cave's secure. What about the queen?
Right. His next move is to find the queen. He goes to her, very respectfully invites her back to her kingdom. She's obviously overjoyed, very grateful.
And does he explain what happened, why she was gone for 3 years?
He does. He tells her about the Bodhisattva's intervention, explains why this happened, this whole breaking the phoenix idea.
That's such a poetic way to put marital separation.
It really is.
Yeah.
But then comes this, well, this wonderfully Wukong moment, getting her back to the palace.
Yes, the transport. How does he manage that? No clouds this time.
No, something much more organic. He finds some soft grass, weaves it into a grass dragon.
A grass dragon?
Seriously? Yep. Tells the queen to sit on it, keep her eyes shut tight, don't be afraid.
Yeah.
And then, using his power, swoosh. They're back in the city, and it says half an hour.
That's incredible. Half an hour. And using grass.
It's that mix, isn't it? Immense power, used for something practical, but with such unique flair. He's not just a fighter. He's a creative problem solver.
He really is. Okay, so they arrive back at the palace. The queen must be thrilled to see it.
Absolutely. She opens her eyes, recognizes her home, leaves the grass dragon Merit. Presumably, it just turns back into grass and hurries with Wukong to the main hall.
And the king sees her. This must be the moment everyone's waited for.
It is. The king is so eager, he apparently jumps off his dragon bed, rushes forward to embrace her.
Finally.
But the instant he touches her, he stumbles back, crying out, "Hand pain, hand pain."
Oh, no. What happened?
It's a shock, right? And Zubaji, who's nearby,
yeah,
has this typically blunt reaction. He just says, "Unlucky, can't even enjoy the reunion, stung the moment they met."
Trust Baji to say it like it is. But seriously, what's going on? Is she cursed? Did the monster do something?
That's what everyone must be thinking. There's immediate concern, officials, other concubines rushing to help the king. But then Wukong steps in.
Okay, Wukong must know. What's his explanation?
And it's a game changer. He reveals the queen has had poisonous thorns all over her body and hand-stinging poison on her hands this whole time.
Poisonous thorns, so it is a curse.
Not exactly. He clarifies this is precisely why the monster, Saitai Sui, could never touch her body or hands during the entire 3 years she was captive on Kulin Mountain.
Wait, so the thorns, they were protection.
Exactly. The thing causing the king pain right now is the very thing that kept her safe and untouched by the monster. It's proof of her purity.
Wow. Okay. That completely flips the script. So this painful reunion is actually, in a weird way, confirmation that she's okay.
Precisely. It's a painful confirmation, but yes. The awkwardness and confusion, though, are palpable. Everyone's worried, helping the king. It creates this tension, this need for a real solution.
It definitely sets the stage. What happens next? How do they fix this?
Well, right in the middle of this chaos and confusion, a voice booms down from the sky. Great sage, I'm here.
Another arrival. Who is it this time?
Wukong looks up, and the description is amazing. Soaring cranes, auspicious light, someone dressed in palm bark clothing that seems to radiate mist, straw sandals holding a dragon beard fly whisk.
Sounds very ethereal.
Very. The text identifies him as the purple cloud immortal from the great Luo heaven.
Okay, a new player. Does Wukong know him?
He does. He recognizes him immediately, calls him Zhang Ziyang, and the immortal responds, introducing himself humbly as Zhang Buduan.
Zhang Ziyang, Zhang Buduan. So there's history there.
Clearly, it signals this isn't random. He's arrived at exactly the right moment.
Yeah.
And he has the real explanation.
Oh, okay. This is the big reveal then.
This is it. Zhang Ziyang explains that 3 years ago, he was just passing by after some Buddhist gathering, and he foresaw what would happen, the king's marital separation worries.
He saw it coming.
Yes. And his main concern wasn't just the kidnapping, but specifically preventing the monster from defiling the queen. He worried it would corrupt human relations and make a true reconciliation impossible later.
So he was thinking ahead about preserving the marriage itself. That's quite profound.
It really is. It shows this deep cosmic respect for human bonds. So he came up with a plan.
Which involved his clothes, the palm bark robe.
Exactly. He took his old palm bark clothing and transformed it. Made it look like a stunning new multicolored cloud-like robe. Then he gave it to the Monster King.
Gave it to the monster. Why?
Deception. He told the monster to have the queen wear it as a new costume. A gift, supposedly.
Clever. And the monster fell for it.
Seems so. And when the queen put this robe on,
the thorns appeared.
Instantly. But Zhang Ziyang clarifies, the poisonous thorns were actually just the palm fibers from his own old robe. It wasn't a curse. It was a physical barrier.
Wow. So the robe itself was the protection. That's brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant. And he says now, knowing Wukong had succeeded in defeating the monster, he's come specifically to undo the enchantment.
To take the robe back, essentially.
Precisely. To remove the protection that's no longer needed and is now causing, well, a bit of pain for the king.
Okay, so Wukong must be eager to get this sorted.
Immediately. He asks Zhang Ziyang to undo it right away.
And how does he do it? Another complicated spell.
Surprisingly simple. Zhang Ziyang just points a finger at the queen.
That's it.
That's it. The palm bark clothing just detaches itself,
mm-hmm.
falls off,
mm-hmm.
and her body is instantly back to normal. No more thorns.
Amazing. Just like that. Problem solved.
Solved with a gesture. It really highlights his power and the elegance of the solution.
So does Zhang Ziyang stick around for thanks?
Not at all. He just shakes out the palm bark robe, puts it back on himself, and when Wukong suggests the king should thank him, he politely declines, gives a bow, and ascends back into the sky.
Wow. Helps out and just leaves. No need for recognition.
A true act of selfless intervention.
Yeah.
The king, queen, all the officials, they're just left bowing towards the sky in gratitude.
That's quite a moment. So now the reunion can happen properly.
Yes. The king orders celebrations, gives thanks to Wukong and the others, and finally, after 3 long years, the king and queen have their proper emotional reconciliation. No more thorns.
That's wonderful. But the journey isn't over for our pilgrims, is it?
Not by a long shot. Amidst all the celebrating, Wukong remembers the formalities. He asks Tang Seng for that challenge letter the monster originally sent.
Oh, right. The letter that started this whole mess?
Well, part of it. Wukong presents it to the king and gives him the full rundown. Everything from the monster sending the letter, Wukong intercepting and dealing with the messenger demon.
His reconnaissance mission.
Right. Then the stolen golden bells, the battles, Guanyin showing up, her explanation about why this trial happened, the breaking the phoenix reason, the whole story.
Bringing the king completely up to speed?
Exactly. And naturally, there's immense gratitude from the whole kingdom. Tan Sang, ever humble, gives credit to the king's good fortune and Wukong's efforts.
But he's not planning on staying for the party, is he?
Definitely not. He's polite but firm. It's time to go. He urges the king to exchange the travel documents so they can continue their journey west immediately. No lingering.
Always focused on the mission. How does the king react to that?
With great respect. The king and queen arrange a huge farewell, And in a really significant gesture, they personally help push the wheels of the pilgrim's carriage as they leave.
Wow, pushing the carriage wheels themselves. That's a powerful symbol of respect and gratitude.
It truly is. It shows just how much they value the monks and their quest.